Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
For Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, President Bush's plans for Americans on the moon and then Mars. A billion-dollar boondoggle or bold vision?
It's something that gives us all a mountaintop experience, but also it's vitally important for inspiring the next generation of scientists and engineers who are going to keep us a strong country.
Also, salmon's great for you, right? A new study finds much depends on whether and where it was farmed.
And unemployment dipped again last month, but there are striking new statistics about how many jobs in the United States go to people who weren't born here.
These stories and a review of Monster, the new film about a female serial killer, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall. Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge today announced that the terror alert will be lowered one step to yellow. Ridge says threat conditions have diminished, but he says the public should still be vigilant.
Yellow still means that we are in elevated risk of attack, and we will maintain particular vigilance around some critical resources and locales. And so the force of Homeland Security continues to move forward.
Ridge says, in his words, certain locales in certain areas will continue to have that higher level of security. A bomb exploded outside a Shiite mosque in Bakuba, Iraq today, about 35 miles north of Baghdad. At least five people were killed and dozens injured. From Baghdad, NPR's Emily Harris reports.
The explosion came just after Friday prayers had finished. Those praying outside, because the mosque was full, were the hardest hit. The mosque building was only slightly damaged, but windows shattered in nearby stores and blood was spattered across the ground as a car in front of the building burned. Mosques have been the site of several attacks around Iraq. Last month, the Sunni mosque was bombed in Baghdad. Three people died. The worst explosion at a holy site was in August, when a car bomb in Najaf killed more than 80 people, including a top Shiite religious leader. Also today, a homemade bomb exploded on a residential street in Baghdad near a U.S. military base. A minibus driver and a child in the car were hurt. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
The Labor Department says U.S. payrolls grew by just 1,000 in December. That happened despite the fact that overall unemployment was down. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The government said the unemployment rate in December fell from 5.9 to 5.7%, but officials said that was mainly because a lot of people have quit looking for work, which technically drives down the overall size of the workforce. The number of jobs created was essentially flat, although there were increases in construction and business services employment. The manufacturing sector continued to lose ground for the 41st straight month. The weak report comes despite numerous signs of a strengthening economy. Stock prices are soaring, consumer confidence is up, and the economy grew 8.2% in the third quarter of last year. In light of that, many economists had predicted a big increase in jobs during December, making today's report a disappointment. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
Manufacturers cut 26,000 jobs in December. It was the 41st month of job losses in factories. Economists say the disappointing news on job creation means the Federal Reserve probably won't change interest rates, which are at 45-year lows. On Wall Street, the Dow is down about 50 points at 10,541 in heavy trading of 687 million shares. The Nasdaq is up about 7 points at 2107. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the former assistant treasurer of Enron, Lee Fastow, has another hour to decide whether to accept a plea agreement. U.S. District Judge David Hittner is demanding that Fastow decide by early this afternoon whether she'll submit to a pre-sentencing report that could recommend harsher punishment. Fastow's attorneys and prosecutors have agreed to a deal in which she would be sentenced to 5 months in prison. A top executive suspected of involvement in the multi-billion-dollar Parmalat fraud scandal turned himself in to Italian authorities today. NPR's Silvia Pagioli reports from Parma, Italy.
Giovanni Bonici, head of Parmalat's Venezuela branch, entered the Parma courthouse today from a back door. Bonici is wanted in connection with his activities as the former chairman of a Parmalat subsidiary in the Cayman Islands that's at the center of the company's bankruptcy. Last month, Parmalat acknowledged that the subsidiary did not have the $5 billion it claimed was in a Bank of America account. In other developments today, Italian financial police searched Bank of America's Milan offices. Yesterday, prosecutors added to their list of 24 suspects a former Bank of America employee. Parmalat founder Callisto Tanzi, who's in jail in Milan, has admitted to a $10 billion shortfall. But the scandal has spread beyond Italy and could implicate numerous international banks. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
Canada's international trade minister says Ottawa can't accept a proposal from Washington designed to end a dispute over U.S. imports of Canadian softwood lumber. The trade minister is scheduled to meet with the U.S. Trade Representative and Commerce Secretary on Monday. I'm Nancy Marshall, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
As long as human beings have gazed up at the night sky, the allure of the moon has inspired dreams. And President Bush, it turns out, is a dreamer too, though with more clout than most to make his visions real. The president next week will announce plans to add to the 12 astronauts who've already landed on the moon. And he'll say he wants men, and or presumably women too, on Mars after that. We're joined now by science journalist Andy Chaikin. He's author of the book Man on the Moon, The Voyages of the Apollo Astronauts. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks very much for joining us. Andrew, let me read you the results of a Gallup poll taken just last month. More than 53% of Americans favored a mission to the moon, but 31% were against the idea if it would cost multi-billions of dollars. Wouldn't it certainly cost multi-billions of dollars to do this?
Well, I mean, in today's budget expenses, that's not saying very much. I mean, the NASA budget is a pretty small fraction. In fact, it's less than 1% of the national budget. And I think what the White House is going to do is call for space exploration, which I think the public supports, but do it within the existing budget framework. So in other words, you know, the reports we're seeing now say that there might be a modest increase in the NASA budget, but that it would not be the kind of enormous infusion of money that we saw during Apollo or that fell on its face when Bush's father tried to announce a space initiative in 1989.
Okay. Well, if they can make an argument financially that it's not that big a deal, why still go to the moon, Andrew? I mean, you wrote a book about it.
How much time you got?
Well, lay it on me.
The moon is scientifically a magnificent place, but I think one of the main reasons why it features so highly in this plan is that it's going to be kind of an outward bound school for the astronauts who end up going to Mars. And, you know, it's just like somebody made the analogy, if you're going to climb Mount Everest, you practice by climbing Mount Rainier, you know, which is no easy feat in itself.
What is it that human beings can do on the moon or on Mars that a robot can't do?
Yeah, well, robots are great, and the robot that just landed on Mars is an incredible creation, and it's going to be a kind of a pathfinder. But once humans get there, the pace of discovery will increase, you know, exponentially. Mm-hmm. And I think that anything we do with robots, humans will always be able to do better. But I think there's another element here too, which is that there's a spiritual benefit that we all get from going where no one has ever been before. And it's something that gives us all a mountaintop experience, a perspective on the greater reality that's out there. But also, it's vitally important for inspiring the next generation of scientists and engineers and innovators who are going to keep us a strong country.
Andrew, just to finish up, none of this will happen even if there's a second Bush term, right? This is still years and years away. How far away?
Well, it's not clear. I haven't seen the details of the plan, but
right.
It's possible that Bush is going to call for finishing the space station sooner rather than later, which means that in the next, 2 to 3 years, we could see the end of the construction of the station and move on to preparing to go out into deep space. After that, who knows, we could see within the next 5 years, 6 years, maybe a flight around the moon. He's talking about landing on the moon by 2013, according to the UPI story yesterday. That's not that far off. That's 9 years. And maybe it'll be just after he leaves office after a second term, if he wins a second term.
Andrew Chaikin, science journalist and author of the book, A Man on the Moon. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The fish that's appearing more and more on American dinner plates has been found to contain high levels of potentially cancer-causing chemicals. This is farmed salmon, once heralded as a healthy way to eat and as a cheaper, environmentally friendly alternative to wild salmon. But a study published today in the journal Science recommends that consumers in some regions limit their consumption of farmed salmon to under one meal a month. Not everyone agrees with that suggestion, and we'll talk about that as well with Ronald Heitz, the Indiana University professor who led the new study. Welcome, Professor.
Hello.
Tell us quickly about your study. You measured PCBs, dioxins, a bunch of other organochlorine chemicals in salmon from around the world, and you found what?
Well, in general, we found that farmed salmon had relatively high levels of these compounds compared to wild salmon. In general, the levels of these compounds were about 10 times higher in farmed salmon than in wild salmon. But at least as interesting, we found that the farmed salmon from various places in the world had really quite different levels. For example, the farmed salmon from Northern Europe had much higher levels of these contaminants than farmed salmon coming to us from Chile.
Hmm.
One of the recommendations we've made in our paper is that farmed salmon be labeled as farmed salmon in the grocery store, the supermarket, but even more importantly, that it be labeled with its country of origin.
Well, where is most of the farmed fish that we eat in the U.S.? Where is that from?
Well, it depends on where we are in the United States. I don't know for Boston and New York, although I suspect some of it does come from Europe. In the Midwest, it's probably coming from Chile. And on the West Coast, it's probably coming from Washington State, Oregon, and British Columbia. Mm. And I should point out that salmon is generally a global market. So salmon is shipped by air all over the world from all of these farms.
Now tell us, where the contaminants that you measured, where are they coming from?
Well, the farmed salmon are fed a mixture of fish meal and oil, and clay and a few colorants and a variety of other things. And the fish meal is produced by essentially raking up trash fish from all over the ocean. And these compound PCBs and these pesticides are distributed through the air on a global basis. There's, of course, more a use of these chemicals in the Northern Hemisphere, particularly around the North Atlantic, which is where most of the world's economy is centered.
Now, you're recommending that people limit their consumption of this farmed salmon, although we've been told that there's benefits to eating fish. Don't the benefits outweigh the risks?
Well, there's, of course, benefits and risks. And I think one of the recommendations in our paper was, in fact, that people need to be aware of both. And we're certainly not recommending that people avoid eating salmon. It's a nutritious food. It's high in certain types of fats that are good for you. But on the other hand, like everything we do in life, you need to make some sort of risk-benefit calculation when you decide what you're going to do.
The Food and Drug Administration is quoted today as saying that if you use the same standards that you used for PCBs in milk, for instance, people would only be able to drink 3 glasses a week. And the FDA tolerance level for PCBs in farmed fish is nearly 55 times the level that you found in farmed fish.
That's true, and there's an interesting problem we've got in the regulatory agencies. The risk assessment we did in the paper used Environmental Protection Agency guidelines, which are very different than Food and Drug Administration guidelines. Mm. And they've never bothered to try and resolve their differences. And one of the things I hope that sort of an indirect result of our paper is that these two agencies get together and resolve these differences.
Professor Heitz, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Ronald Heitz, a professor of public and environmental affairs at Indiana University in Bloomington.
The nation's unemployment rate dropped to 5.7% in December, its lowest level in 14 months, though a Labor Department spokesperson says part of the drop may be as a result of up to 300,000 fewer people looking for work. These figures come on the heels of a new study out of Northeastern University that concludes in the last 3 years, half the country's new jobs went to foreign-born workers who were both legal and illegal immigrants. At the same time, native-born workers have lost over 1 million jobs. Economist Paul Harrington co-authored the study. He joins us from Boston. Welcome, Paul.
Pleasure to be here.
So when we look at the new numbers today, a drop in unemployment, is it too simplistic to say that half the jobs that reappeared went to foreign-born workers, as has been the percentage of new jobs averaged over the past 3 years?
Well, it's actually a tougher story than that. You know, we have two ways we measure jobs. One is the payroll survey and one is the household survey. And there's been a discrepancy between these two numbers. But the household survey in general has been rising since over the last 2 years. And what we found is almost all the gain and the rise in the household survey employment levels has been among foreign-born persons.
Now, explain, though, the difference between those two.
Well, payroll survey, we go out to companies and we say, how many people are on your formal company payroll? And we used to think that measured all the employment opportunities in the American economy. But in this recovery, what we're finding is a lot of employment growth is outside of kind of that formal sector of the economy, in sort of gray labor market, even black labor market areas. You know, things like day work, kind of informal, casual work, a lot more contract work, and a lot more self-employment. And a lot of that is concentrated, it turns out, among foreign-born new entrants into U.S. labor market, at the same time where the number of employed native-born and established immigrants has actually declined.
And the household survey, which measures everybody, indicates that almost all the job growth is foreign-born workers?
Yeah, it's when you take a look at total employment rise between 2000 and 2003, it's up just under 900,000. The number of newly employed foreign-born workers is actually up between, depending on how you estimate it, 1.7 and 1.9 million.
Are they taking jobs that Americans would want to do? The line is usually that most of the foreign-born workers are taking jobs Americans don't want to do.
Yeah, that's a line I don't buy. What we've really seen happening is a lot of squeeze of young adults and youth pushed out of the labor market. That's very typical of what happens in economic recessions because firms quit hiring. They quit hiring young people. And when they lay off, they like to do it by age. So that's very typical. But what we're also seeing now is a lot of firms substituting foreign-born workers for native-born workers. So I think that's the first thing we're seeing happen. But the second thing we're seeing happen is sort of this whole new casual, informal, gray or even black labor market occur that's completely unregulated. I think you'd probably get a lot of bad behavior, both by employers and sometimes by workers out there regarding wages, safety, health issues, and the like.
So this week, President Bush announces a new immigration policy, a guest worker plan, whereby foreign workers already in this country but working illegally could establish for themselves some kind of status in this country for 3 years. The impact of that on all this?
Well, I think what it does is it probably reinforces a signal about people coming in at the bottom of the labor market. On the one hand, I think it's important, I think the president's basic principle that we link labor market demand and immigration policy is an important principle for us to follow. But I think that once we get below that in terms of where I see this policy heading, I'm not sure that it's going to generate the kind of labor supply and the structure of labor market that's really important for us to have in the U.S. You know, the fact is that an awful lot of the immigration is really heavily concentrated, and this depends on the part of the country you're in, among high school dropouts with very low basic skills. And so what we've tended to do is flood the bottom of the labor market, get a lot of substitution of foreign-born for native-born, and push down wages at the bottom.
Paul Harrington is an economist with Northeastern University's Center for Labor Market Studies. He spoke to us from his Boston office. Mr. Harrington, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Just ahead, trying, not always succeeding, to cheat death in the desert to come illegally to the United States.
And later, the film Monster.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The Bush administration's announcement this week of major immigration reforms has focused attention on undocumented workers in the U.S., many of whom risked their lives to get here. A trek across the Sonoran Desert of Arizona from Mexico can take several days on foot. Thousands of illegal immigrants use this crossing because fewer border agents patrol the area. But making it safely across the empty and scorching desert is anything but a sure bet. Last year, more than 150 people died trying to get to El Norte, most of the dead just baked to death. Producers Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler recorded voices of immigrants who have made it across. Their story, called And I Walked, begins with the voice of Charles Bowden, a writer who walked across the desert to see what the immigrants must endure there. Bowden reads from his essay, Blue.
They play a game here, but nobody watches from a box seat. The players are called wets by those who hunt them. They cross a hot desert, a dry desert, and they cross with 1 or 2 gallons of water. They walk 30, 40, 50, 60 miles in order to score. The goal line here means not 6 points, but a job. Here are the rules. Get caught, and you go back to Mexico. Make it across, and you get a job in the fields or the back rooms. Don't make it, and you die.
Crucé la semana pasada.
Sí, caminé 3 días.
3 noches caminando. Íbamos 4 personas.
Solo, caminando por el desierto.
I walk all day on the sun. By the end of the day, I only had 1 gallon of water. I started with 2 gallons.
Un traguito nomás sin mojarse los labios nomás.
In the morning, started walking again. Walk all day, and then still walked part of the night.
Agents found the body of a man believed to be an illegal immigrant hanging from a tree in the desert.
The deaths bring the total number of deaths by crossers in Arizona to 106 for this year. Authorities
people have died trying to cross the Mexican border into Arizona.
There are no springs or streams, and no one lives here. No one. But still they keep coming. Day after day, night after night. Some will move only during daylight because they fear snakes. Some refuse to wear hats. And I cannot help but wonder what kind of experiences produce people willing to take on such ground.
It's a sign of desperation.
They pay better in the U.S. than here. I've just arrived from work, and I start at 7 in the morning, and then I finish at 6. And they paid me $6 for the whole day.
If they could live this fairly good life at their places, I'm pretty sure they wouldn't be here.
With heat and thirst, the body temperature soars and the brain seems to cook. The flesh feels electric with pain as each cell screams out its complaint. People in such circumstances tear off their clothes in the hope of being cooled. Sometimes the border patrol finds corpses with the mouth stuffed with sand.
Bravo 14, Bravo 1.
One incident that I came upon was my eye caught this one bush, and I noticed there's some legs. There was someone lying down underneath a bush. And I thought whoever it was deceased, but when I got upon her, it was a female. She was lying down on her stomach, ready to die.
You start blistering. A lot of blisters on your mouth, around your lips. Start hallucinating and you start thinking, oh, I'm gonna die. But you can't think clearly because it's not you anymore. You start thinking about death. You start thinking if you're going to heaven or if you're going to hell, or I mean, like if you're gonna die in the desert and then you're not gonna be found by anybody and you're gonna be eaten by animals.
The coyotes wanted to eat me. There are a lot of coyotes. The animals wanted to eat me. There were five, and I was staying still and quiet. And they were approaching me, so I put my bottles around me to scare them off. And I had a lighter that I used to fend them off. And I was by myself. The animals were waiting for me to die.
You don't even think. You don't even think. You don't have no brain to think about anything.
Coyotes. A lot of coyotes.
People's going to the United States hoping to find a job and send money to their families back home, and what they find is death. They never make it over there, and they never make it back home.
The desert tonight is an enormous theater full of tracks made by men and women, and sometimes children, all inching north. They play a game here. We play a game here.
Our story, From the Border Region of Arizona, was produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler of KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona. It was commissioned by the Third Coast Audio Festival.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, why is the Bush administration now saying it may have exaggerated claims about weapons of mass destruction?
What they're doing now is they're getting their mea culpas done with so that they can point to that when it comes up in the debates and say, look, he was still a bad man. And furthermore, I think the American public buys that.
And the film about a serial killer, Monster.
People kill each other every day. And for what? For politics. For religion. And they're heroes.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. The national terror alert level has been dropped one step to yellow, the third highest level. However, airports and airlines will keep their high alert status. Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridd says that an urgent threat has passed.
Let me emphasize that although we've returned to yellow, we have not let our guard down. Yellow still means that we are in elevated risk of attack. And we will maintain particular vigilance around some critical resources and locales. And so the force of Homeland Security continues to move forward.
The level was raised to the second highest level on December 21st. That marked the fifth time the level was raised to orange since the system was announced in March of 2002. It has never dipped below yellow, representing an elevated risk. The U.S. reportedly will release 9 British detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and allow them to return home only if they are prevented from engaging in terrorist activity. According to the U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crime Issues, they pose a serious or medium threat and would have to be detained and investigated and/or prosecuted if they return to Britain. Meanwhile, a U.S. general says that some of the hundreds of prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay expressed shock when told recently of the capture of Saddam Hussein. For the first time in 2 years, a commercial flight is carrying passengers from India to Pakistan. Flights between the two countries were halted after Islamic militants attacked India's parliament in 2001. Pakistan resumed its flights to India on New Year's Day. The two countries will hold peace talks next month to resolve the contested border region of Kashmir. The White House says that despite plans for 2 hugely expensive manned space missions, President Bush will propose a responsible budget. The president is reportedly planning a major announcement next week on space policy that may lead to sending Americans to Mars and back to the moon to build a permanent station. Estimates of the cost of the new space exploration top $500 billion. The nation's unemployment rate hit 5.7% in December, the lowest level in more than a year. But analysts say the rate is going down for the wrong reason. The Labor Department says the 0.2% drop in the jobless rate last month occurred because fewer people were looking for work. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are mixed. The Dow is down 53 points at 10,538.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
State Department officials who claimed evidence of weapons of mass destruction a year ago acknowledged yesterday that there was no smoking gun, statements that were prompted by a report which slammed the Bush administration for systematically misrepresenting the threats of WMDs. A big story? Well, it isn't even on the front page of the New York Times today. Mixed messages from the government and from the press. That's one of the topics we're putting before this week's editorial roundtable. Joining us on the line are Pat Walker, editor of the Bucks County Courier-Times in Levittown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Robin.
And Tom Maroney, columnist at the Metro West Daily News in Framingham, Massachusetts. Welcome, Tom.
Hello, everybody.
Well, Pat, let's start with you. What about this story that I don't think has gotten the covers of magazines lately, the weapons of mass destruction? This week, the Carnegie Endowment for Peace said the Bush administration systematically misrepresented the Iraqi WMD threat. Secretary of State Colin Powell, as much as said so yesterday, said there was no smoking gun linking Saddam Hussein to al-Qaeda. And this morning on the Today Show, the State Department's Richard Haass told Katie Couric, well, we might have exaggerated about the weapons and Saddam's link to al-Qaeda. We might have been wrong, but it shows we're human. I'm paraphrasing, of course. Pat?
I think the question of weapons of mass destruction has been sort of lying under the covers as we've rolled through this Operation Iraqi Freedom. And Colin Powell is very quick to point out, no, that's not the only reason we went to Iraq. But I think it's the strongest and most compelling reason that a lot of Americans supported this effort. And I found in that report, which I agree has not gotten the publicity that it should across the country, that I thought it very interesting that they said more than 1,000 inspectors have worked daily since before the war began searching and have found nothing.
Well, Tom, I mean, you know, it may be that they now feel that this other reason, you know, to bring down a despot was a good reason, but that's not the one they gave.
Well, it isn't, Robin, but you know what? I think people who are going to hang their hat on this and try to bring down the president and try to get a Democrat in the White House are really heading in the wrong direction. I think the clearest sign that this is no longer an issue for the American people is the fact that Colin Powell spoke out about it. If the administration was worried that American public opinion would actually be so strong as to hurt them, you wouldn't see Powell out there on this.
You wouldn't see Richard Haass using the word exaggerated.
You wouldn't. I mean, I think what they're doing now is they're getting their mea culpas done with so that they can point to that when it comes up in the debates and say, look, we've already apologized, and by the way, he was still a bad man. And furthermore, I think the American public buys that. And I think this is essentially, whether, you know, people like it or not, a non-issue.
Well, Pat, Tom mentions the debates and, of course, the run for president. Howard Dean graced the covers of Time magazine and Newsweek back in August. That's when they noted the Dean factor. And now he seems to be, constantly on page one with criticism of him. What's happening here?
For all the wrong reasons, I guess he's now being on page one. I think the most interesting thing to follow in all this is the question of the money. Perhaps it's not as much the numbers in the polls that are going to start to worry Dean as it is the fact that Clark seems to be gaining some money.
Mm. You know, Pat, I think you're right, but I also think what struck me about this whole coverage of Dean is how quickly the media, us included, I suppose, turns from being the ones who anoint a front runner, and then within nanoseconds turns around and says, okay, there are problems. There are doubts about Dean.
And, your problem with that is what, Tom?
Well, the thing is, we do have a very vital role in this. We are part of the process. And it's as if we don't give the consumers of the news enough time to catch their breath.
But we can't control what he says. And when he seems to, as they roll through, and not just him, but as they roll through the campaigns, they're changing.
Right.
I think it's our responsibility to point that out.
Well, Tom, what about some of the accusations? Gephardt's campaign is saying that the Dean campaign is plotting to rig the Iowa caucuses by sending in thousands of out-of-state volunteers to vote.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is all sort of what you expect to hear from people in a big fight. And I think to get back to Pat's point, too, the other problem people have with the way the media covers these campaigns is that we spend a lot of time on the horse race and not a whole lot of time, especially in these early stages, on the issues, on telling people who these people are. Time magazine says most people don't know who Dean is yet, and I would have to agree. I mean, we are all immersed in this as news junkies, but I think America is just now starting to pay attention.
I would agree.
Well, I want to move to another political star, at least in some firmament. Hillary Clinton, she got, caught in a gaffe this week. She was at a fundraiser and speaking of Mahatma Gandhi, and she sort of tossed off what she thought was apparently a joke. You know Mahatma Gandhi. He's a guy who runs a gas station down the street.
Some people were appalled. She later apologized for the remark. Are journalists making too much or too little of it, Pat?
Of all people who should know better, you would think Hillary Clinton would. I think probably making just the right amount of it. You know, pointing out that once again the insensitivity, which I, you know, think just feeds the biases that continue to grow, mm-hmm. and politicians need to stop it. There's no need to be funny.
I would agree with Pat. They got it just about right here. But I'd also say this: I don't think this is going to do any sort of damage to Hillary Clinton at all. And I'm not a big fan of her, but she's really laid some serious groundwork to be a presidential candidate next time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to make one quick other reference before we go. We were talking about the Time and Newsweek covers. There's another cover here in Boston. The Boston Herald is a tabloid paper. It's under fire for putting out a fake cover page this week. Every story on the front page was about the debut of JetBlue Airlines in Boston, but there was no disclaimer saying it was an ad, and there was no real cover on the next page. And the Herald is saying, oh, we were just celebrating the debut of this airline. Other papers do that all the time, do sort of mock covers. Tom, the Herald Media Company owns your paper.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts?
It's terrible. And I think that, you know, serious journalists everywhere are going to shake their head, and that we've got to constantly remind ourselves this just is not good business for real journalists.
Mm. You go back to the Jay Leno, Hugh Grant moment. What were you thinking?
Right.
Right. Pat, before we let you go, it is freezing here on the East Coast, and yet they're going to play football this weekend.
And it's a very hot time here in Philadelphia. It's been a very fun week here as cheeseheads battle cheesesteaks, and everything from has peppered our schools right down to folks coming up with ways to have the best tailgate party without any cheese on the menu. So it's been a very fun week. Everybody's looking forward to the game on Sunday when the Eagles play the Packers. And I don't think the cold's going to matter very much.
And, Tom, we got the New England Patriots bundling up Saturday night.
We've got our own game. And Pat, it's colder here in Boston, I'll have you know. And I've already heard some friends of mine say that the Tennessee Titans, when they meet the Patriots on Saturday, are already going to call in sick because it's too cold.
Well, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert.
Stay warm. Tom Maroney, columnist at the Metro West Daily News in Framingham, Massachusetts. Pat Walker, editor of the Bucks County Courier-Times in Levittown, Pennsylvania.
Still to come, female serial killers. And one who doesn't fit the mold, Aileen Wuornos, whose life is told in the new film, Monster.
You're listening to Here and Now. When the United States' first mad cow was announced, at least one man wasn't surprised. Howard Lyman says he predicted it. Lyman is the man who, alongside Oprah Winfrey, found himself on the wrong end of a lawsuit from the cattle industry after he talked about unsavory cattle feed on her program. Also known as the Mad Cowboy, a fourth-generation cattle rancher turned vegan, complete vegetarian, Howard joins us now on the line from Virginia. Welcome.
Hi there.
What exactly did you predict about Mad Cow and U.S. cows?
Well, as far back as 1990, I said that if we continued to feed cattle to cattle, that we had the potential to have something that would make AIDS look like a common cold.
By the way, we should say you won the lawsuit, you and Oprah, that was lodged against you by the cattle industry. By an industry you used to be a big part of.
Well, that's correct. You know, they sued us. We won four times. But, you know, I'm a fourth-generation farmer, rancher, feedlot operator. I spent the majority of my life in animal production, and I have to tell you that what we're doing in factory feedlots today is absolutely, totally non-sustainable.
Howard, you have quite a public relations challenge. Even the high-end stores in our area here in New England, for instance, I cased out a few, they proudly proclaim that they only sell safe beef because it's grain-fed.
Well, I'll tell you, it shows you how little they know about what's going on. We today in the United States are actually feeding ground-up pigs, chickens, turkeys, and horses back to cows, and we're actually feeding cow blood back to cattle. So when they proclaim that everything they're feeding is safe because it's grain-fed, they totally do not understand the industry. They have no idea what the risks are.
Well, because the grain, as we know, can have antibiotics, hormones, other things for the animals, is there such a thing as a safe grain-fed cow? Can you have safe grain?
You can have safe grain, and I would recommend to the consumers out there, if you want to eat meat, go get something that is certified organic.
Or grass-fed.
Grass-fed, that's what the animal was intended to eat.
What, in the short term, would you like to see that would make beef safer?
It's very simple. First thing we ought to do is quit feeding animals back to our food animals. And number two, let's test every animal that's slaughtered. That's exactly what's happening in Japan. They test more animals in a week in Europe than we did in 13 years.
Well, you don't eat meat now, but if nobody ever had any use for any cows, your families and many families' industries would be gone.
Well, I tell you, maybe we should be doing what needs to be done, and that is feed the grain we're growing to people. You know, we have 6 billion people on this planet, and right now 1.25 billion of them go to bed hungry every night. Shouldn't you think that it takes 16 pounds of grain to put 1 pound of meat on your table? 16 pounds of grain will feed 30 people.
One last question. We had an industry spokesperson tell us just a couple days ago that as to the cow itself, that they're very happy in feedlots, that they kick up their hooves and are very happy.
I'll tell you, you were talking to somebody from the industry that doesn't know what's going on. If I was to take you into Kansas when it was raining into a feedlot and where they ended up with hundreds of animals drowning in the manure, I'll tell you what, these animals in factory feedlots are an absolute total disaster. And so anybody that tells you that 100,000 animals in one of those feedlots are having a good time, they're smoking the number one crop out of California.
Howard, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure to be there.
Howard Lyman, he's known as the Mad Cowboy. He spoke to us from Virginia.
There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Aileen Wuornos was a prostitute who killed at least 6 men on the roads of Florida and was executed in 2002 after more than 10 years on death row. Now she's the subject of both a new documentary and a feature film, Monster. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, we're joined by James Fox, professor of criminal justice at Northeastern University here in Boston. Welcome, Professor Fox.
Thank you very much.
Aileen Wuornos was widely referred to in the media as the first female serial killer. Was she?
That's part of the media hype about Wuornos being the first female serial killer. She's not the first female serial killer. Just a few years earlier, in fact, Dorothea Puentes, a Sacramento landlady, killed people who elderly residents of her nursing home. There have been many serial killers since Wuornos and before Wuornos who have been nurses in hospitals who've killed series of patients. We call them angels of death. Aileen Wuornos is unique, however, in that she killed in more of a male fashion. She selected her victims almost at random, had no connection to them, no association with them, and killed them in a very predatory manner.
You mentioned that there were other serial killers. Was there ever anyone who killed even as close to as many men?
There have been black widows, women who've killed a series of husbands for their insurance money. I don't like to get into records and say, well, who holds the record, because there are always challenges someone else to try to break the record.
Plus, that's such an it seems
but she is unusual.
Wrong.
No question. And Aileen Wuornos is unusual in her M.O., in her style of killing. She kills much more of the character of a male serial killer. But she's not unique in terms of being a female serial killer. In fact, about 5% of serial killers are women. Most of them kill people they know. Children. Mary Beth Tinning killed as many as 9 of her own children over a long period of time. They kill patients in hospitals and nursing homes. Very few of them are like Aileen Wuornos, who pick out their victims purely at random.
Have you seen either the documentary or the movie?
Well, I've seen a documentary about her. I've seen a much lesser-known one called The Selling of a Serial Killer. Which came out a few years ago, and today I'm headed to go see Monster.
And what do you think? I mean, so far from what you've seen, have the depictions of her in a documentary form, have they gotten it right?
Well, they try to in documentary forms. Of course, I can't comment about Monster, but I will comment on a made-for-TV movie about her several years ago called Overkill, where Jean Smart played the role
That's
of Aileen
right.
Wuornos.
That's right.
I was disturbed by the dramatization and the editorial license that many writers take for the sake of drama. In that movie, for example, there are conversations between Aileen Wuornos and her dead victims. Conversations from men with real names and real survivors in their family that were not very complimentary. And we really have to worry and wonder when dialogue is contrived by writers for the sake of artistic realism, you have to realize that the people they're portraying in a very negative light have loved ones.
Mm. What would be the one thing you would want actress Charlize Theron, who's said to have the performance of the year in her depiction of Wuornos, what would the one thing you'd want to see from her?
Well, I don't really know quite yet. I will tell you that when I first saw a trailer for the film, and the sound happened to be off my television, I said, boy, that woman looks like Aileen Wuornos. And then I realized that it was, and the movie was about her. So I am very excited to see it, and I do hope that they do try to stay as close to the facts, and that they don't go the route that many serial murder movies have gone, which is to try to over-dramatize, over-sensationalize. After all, these crimes are sensational anyway. And many serial killer movies just miss the mark by pretending to be realistic, yet hardly portraying serial killers in a true light. I hope this movie sheds light on Aileen Wuornos without shedding a spotlight and making her more of a celebrity than she ever deserved.
James Fox, professor of criminal justice at Northeastern University. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The feature film about Aileen Wuornos, Monster, opens in theaters around the country today. And as we heard, Wuornos is played by Charlize Theron, who's already receiving great acclaim for the role. Here and Now film critic Eric Schaefer saw the movie as well, and we asked him, why would anyone want to see a film about a serial killer?
Well, I'll tell you, you go into the video store these days and, you look in the new releases and all you see practically are movies about serial killers.
There is that. There's a whole shelf.
Right. Some are based on facts, some are fiction. But I think there is sort of a fascination with, why would somebody do this? What drives a person to these kinds of acts?
Well, part of the fascination right off the bat, Eric, will be whether the very beautiful Charlize Theron, how does she handle this role?
Well, it's truly amazing. This is really a great performance. She put on weight. She wears bad teeth. She's got this greasy hair, and her skin is mottled from the sun.
But it doesn't have that awful feeling of a beautiful actress becoming...
No, I know that there's always that tendency to kind of really go out and praise actors who kind of undergo a big physical transformation. But in this case, she has simply nailed this character. It is a complete transformation. It's not just the physical stuff, but it's the way she talks. It's the way she moves. It's her gestures and just her overall attitude. You forget that you're watching Charlize Theron in this role. She becomes Aileen Wuornos.
People kill each other every day. And for what? For politics. For religion. And their heroes. No. No, there's a lot of I can't do anymore. But killing's not one of them. And letting those bastards out there go and rape somebody else isn't either.
A film about a female serial killer directed by a woman. Tell me about the director.
Well, this is directed and written by Patty Jenkins. This is her first feature. I think she's done several shorts, but the first film that she's made, and it's a very impressive debut. You know, what's interesting about the movie is that it doesn't concentrate strictly on the murders, and it's not at all really about the investigation behind them. What it is about is the relationship between Warnos and Selby Wall, this young woman. They fall in love, and we really see these two characters, you know, kind of working through their really pretty unhappy lives together. Lee, or Aileen, really wants someone to love her. Selby wants someone who will take care of her. And so a lot of the movie is really about this sort of tense love story between these two women.
Selby, played by Christina Ricci.
Yeah, Christina Ricci, who is also excellent. You know, she is at one moment sort of innocent and kind of sweet and vulnerable, and then she's very manipulative and very clingy.
Man, someday I'm going to take you to some real top-notch places in the Keys, like some real classy joints, you know?
The Keys?
Yeah.
I've always wanted to go to the Keys. I always wanted to have a house on the beach, you know? But I haven't even been to the beach since I've been here.
Girl, I'll buy you a house on the beach, huh? How about that?
Yeah, right. Those places are like thousands and thousands of dollars.
So what? You think I can't get you a house on the beach?
The monster in this film actually, you know, can be several things. We learn that it was the name of a Ferris wheel that Aileen rode as a child. It could also be her, but it could be Selby as well.
So, Eric, a film with a lot of potential to be sensational, a film with also the potential, as we alluded to, of a very beautiful actress trying to sort of almost degrade herself to take on kind of a degree of reality as actresses sometimes do. But you seem to feel the film transcends those pitfalls.
Yeah, it does transcend those pitfalls. A lot of people who are going to go into this movie are going to go in thinking they're going to get a cheap thrill, fans of horror movies and folks like that. I think they're going to be disappointed because this is a much, much more thoughtful movie.
An independent film.
An independent film, a movie that I doubt that, you know, the major studios would have bankrolled. It's a little bit too edgy, a little bit too gritty, but a movie I'm happy to see made because it is an excellent movie on almost every level.
We've been talking about the film Monster with Here and Now film reviewer Eric Schaefer. Eric, as always, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Cradell, Emiko Tomagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Boris Trepatsky and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
Mountain lions in California. One is killed for attacking a human.
And shape note singing from rural England to the new America to the film Cold Mountain.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.